We are here tonight for a really easy topic. In fact, I don't know why we need to convene this panel of experts for the topic of Washington. Why can't they all just get along? Isn't there an easy answer to that?
No.
We will try. We'll try to find one. And in doing so, I want to thank tonight our sponsor for this session, which is part of the American Experience Track, Allstate. They have helped to underwrite the Aspen Ideas Festival this year, and we're grateful to them for bringing this group together to talk about Washington and why Washington can't get along. Leading that conversation, so helping us to find the answers, to my right is colleague and friend Gwen Ifill, who is the moderator and managing editor of Washington Week, which is the longest-running public affairs program on PBS. Gwen's also a senior correspondent on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, and in her previous life, she has covered White House and politics as well as local affairs for news organizations such as NBC News, The New York Times, Washington Post, and the Baltimore Evening Sun. She has 15 honorary degrees to her credit. I won't ask you to name them all, though I'm sure you could, and has many, many board seats. And some of you might have been with us last evening when we taped Washington Week at the Hotel Jerome. So it was broadcast this week from Aspen and from the Aspen Ideas Festival. Next to Gwen, we have Mort Kondracki, who is one of the Beltway Boys. He is executive editor of Roll Call, as a commentator, is frequently on TV, on Fox News in particular, with Brit Hume and on the Beltway Boys. He was on the McLaughlin Group for 16 years and was previously executive editor of The New Republic and the Washington Bureau Chief of Newsweek. And next to Mort, we have the woman who needs no introduction, Andrea Mitchell.
I like introductions.
Chief foreign correspondent for NBC News. She appears on NBC, CNBC, and MSNBC. She has covered every presidential election since 1972 and every president from Carter through Bush.
She was in her cradle.
And has a wonderful book I'd recommend to you all called Talking Back to Presidents, Dictators, and Assorted Scoundrels, and is a winner of the Goldsmith Career Award for Excellence in Journalism from the Kennedy School. Next to Andrea is my colleague and friend, Carl Cannon, who is the White House correspondent for the National Journal. He has been in that post since 1998, so about to celebrate your 10th anniversary. We'll have to mark that in some way. Previously, he was with six newspapers across 20 years, was president of the White House Correspondents Association, the winner of the Gerald R. Ford Prize for Distinguished Reporting on the Presidency. He's an author, including The Pursuit of Happiness in Times of War, and a co-author of Boy Genius about Karl Rove. I hope you'll go to his session tomorrow.
I'll be there.
Maybe you know it all already. And is a graduate of the University of Colorado, for any of you who are natives here. And last but surely not least, what did you call him, Carl? Where's Tall?
Tall.
David Gergen, who is the public service professor of public leadership and the director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's a previous editor of U.S. News and World Report and is current editor at large, and was a White House advisor to four presidents over three decades, including Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton, so spanning the spectrum. So this is our gang who will answer the question of Washington, why can't they all just get along? And I'll leave it to you, Gwen.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, everybody. We are thrilled to be here. We are also, as you're going to see, a very interesting thing tonight, because usually on Washington Week, I maintain complete control by fear and intimidation over the panelists. I can't do that with any of these four. So basically, I'm going to start the motor running and see where we go. I ran into Mort earlier today, and I said, what is it we're talking about tonight? And I boiled it down. I call it the Rodney King question. You know, why can't we all just get along? But I want to turn it on its head as we start the conversation tonight, because it's going to be kind of wide ranging. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about whatever else you want, because you see there are microphones out there. And as always at these sessions, we'll take some of your questions. But I'm going to turn the question on its head just for argument's sake, as is my wont. Why is it necessary that we all get along? Isn't democracy about debate and disagreement and engagement? Isn't getting along overrated, Mort?
Well, look, there's always going to be debate, and there should be debate, and there's going to be differences, and the parties exist because they have different philosophies about lots of things. But it occurs to me that there are problems that America faces, big ones, that can only be solved on a bipartisan basis and with a series of grand bargains. And a lot of them are what we've been talking about endlessly at the Ideas Festival here. You know, how do we improve American education? You're going to have a grand bargain where you're going to raise teacher salaries. Republicans have got to agree to some revenues there. And Democrats have got to agree to abandon the teachers' unions to the extent, at least, of imposing on teachers some professional discipline. And so on down the line. I mean, you can't solve Social Security without a grand bargain. You can't solve, I don't think, our energy slash environmental problem without a grand bargain. And right now, the two parties are at loggerheads about everything, the latest of which was the immigration bill. Nothing of substance is going to pass in this Congress. It is a totally polarized Congress. And there was a brief moment right after the 2006 election, when both parties agreed that the message of the 2006 election was that the public is fed up with this partisanship, that they would like to have the parties work across the aisle and get things done in their interest and stuff like that. And it's the story is told, I don't know, it's apocryphal, it's probably not true, I'm sure it's not true, that during this brief interval, Dick Cheney actually called up Nancy Pelosi and invited her to come on a hunting trip with him to Texas. and so that's about the extent of what we've seen in Washington. I think that it's up to the next president to try to be a real uniter, not a divider, not a polarizer, the way George Bush has been. And I don't know if it can happen.
Can it happen, Andrea? Are grand bargains possible or even desirable?
I think grand bargains are desirable. I'm not sure about possible. But I think that Mort has very accurately defined these huge issues that need to be addressed. I'm not even sure we can wait 18 months. And if you look at the subjects that are not being discussed in this campaign so far, and I acknowledge that this is the introducing stage of the candidates, and we are more interested in their personalities and character, but at some point, I would hope that we talk not only about education and health care, but financing health care, not only defining problems, but defining solutions. And that cannot take place unless there is a center that holds. I was talking to one member, more of a centrist member of the House, who said to me tonight, we need a caucus of 270. We need to bring the center together and just ignore the edges and come together with the kind of group that used to exist in the United States Senate when I was first covering it. There were, in the late 80s and early 90s, about 20 mainstream moderate senators, Democrats and Republicans, and I'm talking about the Danforths and the Nuns and the Borens, you know, people in both parties, Durenberger, the late John Chafee, obviously Pat Moynihan, great people no longer with us, who were working on solutions and who in fact were working on a healthcare solution and were thinking of embracing Hillary care at the time. And then they saw with some of the problems, quote unquote, that the Clinton White House had in those early years, they saw that there was no need, or the more aggressive Republican leaders said there's no need to really cooperate and undercut this centrist group. And we haven't really seen a group like that. And over the years, you've seen a lot of these people leave the Senate because we don't get along. And I think it's precisely the kind of hostile, vituperative politics and what cable talk, cable news, what my profession on the edges bring to it, the velocity of the conversation, the lack of civil discourse, the rewarding of comments that are on the outrageous edge. All of that has conspired, and we are complicit, we in the media, to create an atmosphere in which nothing can be solved. The problems are way too big to be ignored. And as I say, I don't think we can wait for the next president.
Carl?
Well, you'd ask the question, do we really need to get along? And Mort gave you his answer. I want to add one thing to that and put it in less theoretical terms. We did there's polling out on the Korean War and the Vietnam War by party, who was against it, who was for it. And there were gaps based on who was in the White House. If you're a president, if the president was not of your party and he was the president during an unpopular war, you were less likely to support it by 10 points or so. In this war, it's by 80 points. In other words, you can tell if someone's for against Iraq by their party. And this is not in the last year when it's gone bad. This is from 2004. Think of the implications of that for a minute. So is this a Republican war? Is this a Republican army there, the all-volunteer army? The implications of what we've done to our system here are much worse than we can imagine. It's not just getting a good education bill. They can't agree on anything. They can't get a good bankruptcy bill. There's an issue. That's not a partisan issue, but they turned it into one. And the Democrats were all worried about the people who were getting their interest rates jacked up when they missed a mortgage payment, but they got sick, as they should have been. The Republicans were worried about the fraud in the banks. And guess what happened? No compromise bill. Republicans got their bill because they had more votes. They got a bill, straight party line vote, on an issue that shouldn't even be partisan. War shouldn't be partisan. And so the country, Washington's not functioning now. So I think they have to figure out how to do it. But the problems are, it's so much deeper than just a president, Mort. I mean, you said that Bush is polarizing. I actually think the problem may be worse than that. He may not be polarizing. I heard this about Hillary Clinton. George Clooney says she's the most polarizing person in the country. We heard it about Bill Clinton. What do those three have in common? Well, they're strong personalities, but that's not really what polarization is. They're well known in their parties. In other words, they have 100% name ID and they're identified with a party. What's happening now is that anybody's going to be the environment is polarized. And so getting out of this is going to take more than just a president speaking nice words. It's going to take more than a vice president calling a speaker, even if it's not for a hunting trip but for a dinner. It's going to take real action.
You know, now that we've gotten George Clooney into the conversation, I can go home and know I've served my purpose. David, you have been over your career the very face of nonpartisanship, going across party lines where it seemed necessary in order to get things done. Does that work anymore?
Well, let me go back to the original point, and that is politics about struggle? James McGregor Burns, one of our foremost political scientists, historians, and by the way, very liberal Democrat, believes that the essence of politics is struggle. It's strife. It's competition of ideas. That's what political parties are about. And so one should not ignore that. One should not. And I tell my liberal friends, listen, you may not like what the conservatives stand for, but you ought to appreciate the fact that they fought their way out of the wilderness in the mid-60s after Goldwater, and they struggled very hard because they cared a lot about what they believed, and they got in the arena, and they worked like hell, and they finally won office, and they took over. And one of the problems with the progressives and the liberals for so long has been they don't want to get in the arena and fight. You've got to be out there in the arena to struggle for what you believe. You can't sit on the sidelines and sort of look at this and say, well, you know, the pox in all our houses. Conservatives understand this is about power. And the liberals have got to understand this is about power, too. And if you really want to govern, if you want to have Hillary Clinton in the White House, or if you want to have Barack Obama in the White House, whoever it may be, you better be thinking about how can that person govern, not just win the White House. What difference does it make if you have the power, if the office, if you can't get anything done? So start off with that proposition. But I will say this, and I think this has been true, and Andrea and I think Mort both can appreciate this, we all go back a bit. But I think when we came to Washington, there was a sense with the World War II generation that when they were sort of essentially in the positions of governance in the country, the people who were the young lieutenants and the people who came through the 40s and then went on to govern the country basically from John Kennedy through George Bush Sr., they understood the struggle for power, but my experience with most of them was that they thought of themselves as strong Democrats or strong Republicans, but they thought of themselves as first and foremost strong Americans. So that at the end of the day, after they'd had their struggle, and they would fight like hell, you know, all day in politics, but at 5 o'clock at night, they could put down their differences and lift up a glass and enjoy each other's company and appreciate, look, you believe in this, I believe in this, but we all have this larger commitment. So that even a Ronald Reagan and a Tip O'Neill, who are strong partisans, they could still put down their differences at the end of the day and see if they couldn't work it out in the name of the country. And they could still enjoy and appreciate each other's company and have respect for the other individual.
David?
Yep, just 1 second. So when Tip turned 70, Reagan had a birthday party for him at the White House, a luncheon. And he brought down a lot of Tip's friends. And at the end of the lunch, Reagan got up and he gave us a little toast. And it was this, he liked to write out this little doggerel. And he got up and he said, Tip, if you had a ticket, if I had a ticket to heaven and you didn't have one too, well, I'd give my ticket back and go to hell with you. That was the spirit of that generation, and we've lost it.
What I was going to say is that I sometimes wonder when I listen to us talk about the grand old times when everybody got along and shared a drink at the end of the day. I wonder if we're not talking about going back to hot type or going back to things which we're never going to go back to, going back to whether we have now reached a point where we have to deal with the way it is. And the way it is that we're not going to ever sit around a table and have that kind of conversation again. Mort?
I think that there really is a new politics struggling to be born. And it's a politics of convergence. And it's not just, Barack Obama is sort of enunciating it rhetorically. I would like to see some follow through. I'm sort of discouraged that he, in the process of the primaries, is getting as polarizing as anybody else, you know. But nonetheless, his saying that we need to turn the page, we need to end the ferocity, the partisan ferocity of the old generation, I think that's one sign. Arnold Schwarzenegger talking about post-partisanship in California and reaching out to Democrats and so on. The Bloomberg possibility of a Bloomberg candidacy, whatever that represents. And I think the public will. I think the public really does want its problems solved, and that generally speaking, if the public wants something badly enough, it will represent itself in its politics. And the last sign of this, the good news, is that there are all these strange bedfellows coalitions that are forming around possible solutions to problems. I mean, the AARP, the SEIU, the Service Employees Union, which is one of the most liberal unions, and the Business Roundtable are in a coalition on behalf of universal health care coverage and entitlement reform, wherein the AARP is acknowledging that there is going to have to be a shave back of benefits for future retirees. Now, that's a big concession on their part. And you've got it. You got lots of stuff happening on energy. You got lots of stuff happening on education. Things are happening on healthcare. At this very place today, we had three really reasonably liberal people: Chris Jennings, who was Clinton's healthcare advisor, and Zeke Emanuel, Rahm's brother, and who was the third one? I can't remember. Anyway, we're talking about convergent solutions to the healthcare problem. So, I mean, it's there, you know, and if candidates would start taking some of these strange bedfellows coalitions and start talking in terms of grand bargain, I really think something could happen.
Let me pick up from that and ask Andrea. In an election year, when people are trying to benefit to win by emphasizing their difference and distinction from one another, is there any benefit to be gained by trying to show how much you agree with people who disagree with you? Or is there more to be gained for a candidate in saying, look how different I am from everyone else?
Well, I think Barack Obama has tapped into this hunger in America for people to think beyond the traditional labels of partisan politics. Now, he has been less specific and less crisp in his responses during the initial debates, and this is a learning curve, perhaps. Hillary Clinton tends to be better at rallies, better at debates, Obama better at rallies. They have a different skill set as candidates. So he has not yet adapted enough to the debate format for all of his fundraising prowess and the extraordinary appeal he's had in 250,000 individual donors. So he's a force to be reckoned with, and I think his appeal is precisely the desperate need that people feel. The post-06 election certainly expressed that. People want leadership, and unfortunately, I think the people we have in Washington right now, for the most part, are still responding to the lowest common denominator. The immigration debate, if you can call it that, was a classic example of no one expressing any leadership, of the media just dragging people down. And I'm saying some of the talk shows that absolutely ignore the facts. People who know better, who have economic backgrounds and are doing shrill diatribes on the subject of immigration and building, you know, building on people's fears, playing to people's fears. That is where we have to come in. We need a better educated public to demand more of our leaders, but we also need leaders who don't play to the fears of our people. And I think that it is possible in an election year because, I mean, you know, Bloomberg may be the person to tap into that if the stars all align the way, you know, he thinks could possibly happen if there is a, you know, if other of the candidates self-destruct. Maybe not. But I think that we are ignoring the real aspirations and the intelligence of the electorate.
Carl?
Well, I agree with what Andrea said. And what Mort said, actually, about the hunger out there. In fact, go back to 1992. We think of that now as the election that brought Bill Clinton to power, but he won 43.5% of the vote. That was an election in which you had two candidates, Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush, who are not extremes of their party. They seem relatively moderate today. And yet, even with that field, you had a guy in the middle who, after he said he believed in aliens, got 19% of the vote. That's the hunger that's out there. Now, Bloomberg's not going to say he believes in aliens.
Hunger for what? Insanity? Is that what we would have?
I think
for
an alternative to these two parties and their polarizing views on every issue. Can I take 1 minute, Gwen, and just
by all means,
say why I think to understand why we need a third party. Understand where the two parties have come. We had for years a de facto third party. We didn't know that. We didn't call it that. It was the white Southern Democrats. And we, if you were from California like I am, I just thought of them as a racist party. I didn't take them very seriously. And race was, for 100 years, their central organizing principle. But it turns out that's not all there was. They were moderate on military issues or conservative. They were sensible on workplace stuff. They were a centrist party. Again, you take race out of it. I know that's like asking to take the iceberg out of the Titanic's last voyage, but take it out for a minute on military things. And you had this sort of moderating party in the Congress and in the Senate. And so things, you had to build a consensus. They were sort of the tiebreaker. They're gone now. And what you have now is this party, and think of all the pressures. Elaine Kmark and Bill Galston call it the great sorting out. We've gone to the British model. If you're a liberal now, you're a Democrat. That wasn't always true. Regionalism's gone now. If you're a conservative, you're a Republican. The districts then get all gerrymandered. All of the pressures are continuing to drive people to the polls. And so you have a very conservative Republican Party and a liberal and a Democratic Party. It's more liberal than the country, and the Democratic caucus in the House is more liberal than the party. And that's why they can't get along, because they don't see things. They look at two different worlds. That's the context in which I think maybe a president may be one answer, but maybe a third party is the other answer.
Yeah, when I want to go back to the point about can we go back to the past? I think the past shows us that it is possible to break out of periods like this. This isn't the first time we've had this kind of partisanship, this kind of bitterness and paralysis. The late 19th century was a classic period when for 20 years, you know, our politics were sort of red tooth and claw. They were very bitter. And then along came the progressive movement. And what we found was we broke out of that, and we had a Republican, Teddy Roosevelt, who kicked it off, but we also had a Democrat, Woodrow Wilson, who built on that. And it was not one party or the other. It was a new politics. And I think Mort is on something important. There is, I think he's right about saying that there is a new politics that's seeking to be born. You sense it in a lot of different places. It's happening in some key states. You know, he talked about California with Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger tried to change the system and gave up on that, but then, you know, is now governing in a very sort of almost postpartisan way. And he's very popular. In the state of Ohio, we have a new Democratic governor in Strickland, and he's working with a Republican legislature, and they're working very, very well together. It's they're really working across the aisles in this new politics, and Strickland's very popular. In Florida, Governor Crist, a new Republican governor, he's working across the aisles, and they're beginning to build something. That's happening in a number of communities, and the question is, will it happen fast enough to deal with how big the problems are that we're facing? But I think Ward is right about saying there is something new in the air. It's encouraging, and I think corporate America is also part of that. There are parts of corporate America which are against it, but there are other parts of corporate America, as on this healthcare issue, which are really, we ought to be encouraging along. We ought to find some hope in that.
David, it sounds like the examples you cite, that you're basically saying that the solution for us getting along lies outside of Washington, that it either lies in the corporate arena or it lies in the state house, but there's not much hope of that happening in Washington.
I believe that most important change starts outside Washington and it sweeps into Washington. You know, the people in Washington are not at the forefront of change. They're not leading indicators, they're lagging indicators. And I think that's been historically true. Conservatism, the wave that brought Reagan in 1980, you could see out around the country in Prop 13 and a lot of other things long before Reagan got elected. I think a lot happens at the grassroots level and then Washington begins to change.
I think that's what David Broder, our colleague and friend, has been writing about for many, many years. Very astutely, that kind of change can start in the states, particularly in the last 7 years, 6.5 years. What we saw, I think, initially from this administration was a disdain for Congress that previous Republican administrations did not share. Now, in the Reagan administration, which I first covered and knew Carl and David in, there was a legislative strategy group. And they knew they were dealing with Democratic majorities. And so Jim Baker in the White House would have morning meetings every day and really adept people dealing with Congress and building different kinds of coalitions, the boll weevils, that's back when Phil Graham was a Democrat, before he became a Republican. And these are the kinds of coalitions that they put together. Someone would say co-opting the late Les Aspin to get the AWACS deal through. But they did big things by creating coalitions because they knew they had to. Bill Clinton, similarly, had the same kind of strategy in getting the first economic plan through.
I agree with that.
We didn't see that from this White House. There was a general feeling very early on, I think, that the power had shifted too much to the Hill and that they wanted to reassert executive powers. And we've seen a very sad result of this because for the first numbers of years, no one even talked to the Democratic minority leaders. And the Republican majority leaders on the Hill didn't even meet with their counterparts.
That's right. But, Andrea, it's also true. To go back to something like welfare reform, welfare reform started in places like Wisconsin with Tommy Thompson. It started in some of these, welfare to work was an experiment in a number of states. And then it gradually worked its way until Bill Clinton could embrace it and became he'd been out there in the states working on
it. He didn't embrace it. He vetoed it twice.
No,
he signed it reluctantly.
No, he was for welfare
but
to work.
He also campaigned on it. He said, what was the line? An end to welfare as we know it, or something like that. I mean, he ran on that platform. It's just that the Republicans carried it to wretched excess, and he vetoed it twice.
Exactly.
Several of you have mentioned the campaign of Barack Obama and the degree to which there seems to be a hunger. And I spent the better part of this year so far trying to figure out what is it about that campaign which has caught fire and what makes it different from other things we've seen catch fire, like, say, Howard Dean 4 years ago, who had his big boomlet. And I asked this question yesterday on Washington Week of Dan Baltz, the Washington Post, who we all know, who is a great political reporter. And his take on it, I'm curious of your response to his take on it, is that it's a difference of hope versus anger, and that the Dean supporters and the Dean boomlet was born out of almost out of fury, and that there's something else gentler but no less insistent happening with the Obama boom.
If you read Obama's book, his second book, it's all about a generational turning of the page, that what you've got in power now is a bunch of 60s veterans who are either on the right side or the left side of the great cultural struggles of the 1960s, Vietnam, sexual revolution, drugs, all that kind of stuff, and they're still battling that out. I mean, they've converted it to abortion and stem cells and all that stuff, but it's still the same old fight. And that he represents something different, a passage of time and a passage of generation, and that those people, the new generation, doesn't want to fight those battles anymore. And that I think that's part of it. I think he's also, he is a product of a state legislature. A recent arrival in Washington hasn't drunk the poison yet. And although I got to say, he shows signs of.
It's the second time you've mentioned it. What are the signs?
Well, I mean, look at Iraq, the position on Iraq. I mean, the primary process is driving all the Democrats to the left and all the Republicans to the right. You can see it in Mitt Romney on all kinds of cultural issues. He's way off to the right. And on the war, both Hillary and Obama said at a certain point that it would be a mistake to set deadlines. It would be for withdrawal. Now they're all in favor of setting deadlines. Both Hillary and Obama have been talking about healthcare in terms of beating up on the insurance companies and the drug companies, who will be necessary parts of whatever solution there is to be found. And there's just a tendency to pander.
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. There is a tendency to pander, but I'm not sure that the war is one, is altogether that. I think the situation on the ground is driving their positions on the war. The fact that deadlines and benchmarks have not been met, there is no sign that the Maliki government is ever going to rise to being anything other than sectarian leadership, that the prognosis from our military leaders has been repeatedly decisively wrong, and that as well as public opinion, yes, and a certain degree of pandering is driving it. But I think in Obama's defense on the war, he has been consistent against it from the beginning. It is Senator Clinton who has moved on the war, and she says it's because the events have driven her that way. You can,
people who are switching on the war are Republicans. Senator Lugar switched on this. Senator Voinovich has switched on this. We've had Senator Domenici, as Andrew reported, here in a panel a couple days ago.
Warner next week.
Senator Warner. From my point of view, Mort, I do think there's some demagoguery on both sides, but I actually think I've been surprised at how sort of cautious Mrs. Clinton and Barack Obama have been about the war. They haven't been stampeded over to the left. They're not into a total anti-war, pull out all the troops, let's come home tomorrow. They're not playing McGovern in this campaign, would be political suicide for them to play McGovern. The facts on the ground are driving a lot of people, among them the leading Republicans, to sort of say maybe we ought to have Plan B.
I want to make this about Iraq, but it is significant that both Obama and Hillary Clinton voted to defund the war. I mean, when the final supplemental vote came up, Joe Biden voted for it. The two of them voted against it. Now, that was a pander. It simply was.
But wait a second. Was it a pander, or was it what I was talking about earlier, which is that maybe there are times when disagreement is the stuff of what politics and policy is supposed to be? Is it possible to vote to defund the war and not be pandering?
I suppose, but I think that Joe Biden did the responsible thing. You've got troops in the field. They've got to be funded. You can't, they both knew that the funding was going to pass. So it was a symbolic vote, if you like. But it was a vote that was meant to appeal to the primary voters of their party. If Hillary had voted in favor of that.
Why wouldn't they?
Are Republican senators pandering? Or is Senator Lugar pandering?
No. I think they're...
That's a good question,
I think they're...
Dave.
Well...
Thanks.
I think they're representing what they believe is their...
So when a Republican switch positions, it's not pandering
to
Democrats?
I don't know. That's why I don't want to make this the centerpiece of this whole thing. Suffice it to say that it certainly, they are moving. They are moving left on the war, and they are moving left on the war during the primary season. You know, it's partly what's happening on the ground, but everybody could have anticipated what was happening on the ground, you know, that the surge was not going to accomplish everything that it was supposed to accomplish. And at one point, they said that they would not set deadlines, and now they're setting deadlines. And at one point, they said, Hillary said a year ago to this left-wing group that she addressed just the other week that it would be irresponsible to vote to defund the troops, and she voted to defund the troops. So something has changed. And I submit that voting to defund the troops is irresponsible.
I would like to not focus completely on the Democratic side of this equation, because one of the things we say that we like in Washington is for people to stand, to not pander, to stand by their principles and to decide they believe a certain set of things and stick with it. And you know what? That's what John McCain did. John McCain decided he believed that this immigration reform was necessary, and he stuck by it. He decided that Iraq was a war that was worth fighting, and he stuck by it. And he's got $2 million in the bank, and he's spending it like a, you know, drunken sailor, as he would probably say, every single day. Is there any political reward for standing by your beliefs?
John McCain is a great example of someone who is being punished for showing some leadership on two issues, immigration and the war, because he stood by his beliefs on the war, and it goes contrary to public opinion, even within his own party, increasingly.
Isn't that what we say we want?
Exactly. No, I think he's also being punished for his embrace of some of the evangelicals last year. When he began to switch last year, he lost the glow of independence and of being a straight talker in many people's minds. I think he's paying a terrible price for that, because he lost those independent supporters with that move, and he will never regain some of the hardcore conservatives in his party who will not forgive him for running against George W. Bush in 2000.
So I'm going to ask this question. I'm going to ask people who have questions to start lining up with the microphones, too, because time is flying. So who on the Republican side, Carl, is poised to take the John McCain mantle, or whatever mantle of, you know, principled, you know, middle of the road, speaking to most of America?
Well, none of them want to be McCain. They all
no kidding. Based on what they've seen,
they all want to be Reagan and
Arthur Branch.
Or Arthur Branch.
If you line them all up, there's eight or what, 30? How many there are? They all remind you
18
little,
in both parties.
A little
right
thing,
now.
A little node on Reagan's rump or a hair on his head or something. They've got something. Fred Thompson.
What?
Fred Thompson.
Yeah, he did say that.
I was trying to see, Fred, when you weren't listening, and I knew that.
I drifted off for a moment.
They all want to be Reagan, but they're not Reagan. Who's the latest Reagan? Fred Thompson. Now, all right, what was Reagan? President of the Screen Actors Guild and a leading man for 30 years. What's Fred Thompson? A character actor on television and a bit player. So that's, and they're all like that. They all want to be Reagan. They don't want to be McCain. You asked me who, if you're getting me to say who's going to emerge, I have no idea. But the person who seems to be putting it together and understand what he's doing right now is Mitt Romney. But I don't know if that'll last. You've got a field. Every poll tells you the next president's going to be a Democrat. That's why we end up talking about Democrats up here, not because we're rooting for one, but that just seems to be where the action is. But I've got a brief story to tell you that connects George W. Bush, John McCain, and Barack Obama. And it's this, and it's a two-sentence story. Do you all know who Mark McKinnon is, the ad guy? He's a Texan. He worked for Ann Richards and then George W. Bush. He's the only person who did that. And then he went to work. He's now working for McCain. And when I was up at Harvard with David last semester, I was out for drinks with McKinnon, and he told me flatly that if Barack Obama's the nominee, he'll quit the McCain campaign. Hmm. He loves McCain, but he said, I'm not going to work against this guy. You asked about Barack Obama. He is a vessel into which people are pouring their dreams.
And he says that.
And it's true. And he is McKinnon's phrase was, he's the hope machine. And he's this guy. He can't possibly fulfill all what we want, but he can do some of it. He gets us past race. He gets us past the generational thing of the 60s, a lot of things. He's the new person. He does not resemble Howard Dean to me, more like John Kennedy. And so I think he's the candidate.
Okay, I'm gonna pull back on the Barack bandwagon here. Okay. It's making me nervous.
Well, let me just point out one other thing, another disappointment. I've written columns about the grand hope of Barack Obama, and I want him to fulfill those hopes because I believe this represents a new policy. But the immigration debate comes up, and Obama voted along with Hillary for poison pill amendments that they knew were poison pill amendments to the immigration bill. AFL-CIO friendly amendments to the bill to sunset temporary worker programs and stuff like that. They were not behaving like convergence politicians to get this problem solved.
I want to say just one thing, but we should not leave this room thinking that Barack Obama is just sort of busting through in our politics. I think to go back to Mort's point, there's a new politics waiting to be born. It has not yet been born yet. My sense, and maybe I'm wrong about this, because it's always hard to, when young people are energized the way they are for Barack, it's very hard to know exactly what that's going to lead to. It's unpredictable. It may lead to a lot, as it did with Eugene McCarthy, or it may fizzle, as it did with Howard Dean. You just don't know. But I would have to tell you that from where I sit right now, the Barack Obama bandwagon is slowing down. It's not stalled, but it's slowing down. And that the dynamics in this race, despite the money, the dynamics of this race are moving toward Hillary Clinton. And I think she's more likely to get their Democratic nomination than she was 3 months ago.
On that note, sir.
Yes, my name's Larry Gelman. I live in Arizona. And I was watching Mort Kondracki's show tonight, The Beltway Boys, which I assume was taped.
I've discovered how to be in two places at once.
But you interviewed a state legislator from Arizona, or a state legislator, and Jeff Flake, who's a congressman, both Republicans. In Arizona. I moved there 6 years ago from Wisconsin. It was the first time I ever lived in a red state in my life. And I thought it was going to be very different. And it has been to a point. But I have to say, I think what's going on in Arizona may be a paradigm for what may be happening around the country when you talk about a desire for the middle. People like Randy Graff and J.D. Hayworth, who were very strong anti-immigration, supposedly playing to the strength of the Republican base in the state, lost their elections this year. We went from having eight Republicans to three.
What's your question?
My question is, do you think that there is any hope that the infrastructure and leadership of the Republican Party, or either party for that matter, will pick up on a sense of what I think and what you alluded to is going on in the country, that the base, the so-called base that power had been conceded to for so long, no longer really represents the will not only of the broad people, but even people in their own party in time to make a difference in the election coming up in a year and a half?
Andrea?
I don't know about in time, but I think you're on to something. And I think we alluded to it earlier when we talked about what Schwarzenegger is doing in California. There are good examples in your state, also in New Mexico and elsewhere. There are coalitions of people coming together to solve problems because I think they are despairing of Washington doing it for them. And there are some problems, though, that are too big for states to solve. One is, Social Security. Another is a broad-based health care financial solution. And that's why we still need, the other obviously is war and peace and intelligence and border controls. So the states can't be the solutions to everything, but they sure are, I think, great laboratories, and in particular on education.
I just want to say that if people like Jeff Flake are not rewarded by the Republican Party in places like Arizona, then Arizona will not be a Republican state for long.
Yeah.
Sir.
Yes, Andrea Mitchell referenced in the late 80s and early 90s, 20 great senators, Boren, Nunn, Danforth, Moynihan. It's been my observation in the last two election cycles, the quality of the timber that we're sending to the U.S. Senate, the lack of intellect, the lack of talent, we're sending some unremarkable people, I think, to the Senate. I'm just curious if you all agree, disagree.
You want to name any names?
Senator Martinez of Florida. How about that one?
I'm not going to name names, but I'm going to say, I think you're absolutely correct, and I would blame the money. When David Boren once came on Meet the Press before he quit the Senate, and I was hosting, and I tried to drill down on why he was leaving. He was intelligence chair. He was a power broker in his own right. And he said, we're chasing so much money. I'm spending all my time raising money. And this was back, I think, in 1994. I could be wrong on the year when he left, but it was in the early 90s when he left. And the amount of money that is now out there and that they have, the fundraising that goes on, dare I say it, even in this town, this evening.
This scary moment.
The amount of money that has to be chased by these people eliminates a lot of bright, talented, public service-minded, young or middle-aged or old people who would want to serve their fellow citizens in the government. It is an appalling price tag on these races.
Sir. Actually, it's a follow-on to your last comment. As we've discussed this tonight, David Kunyon from New York, but there seems to be two major pieces missing from your analysis. You just alluded to money isn't a huge engine of why the demonization has taken place is because from the party structure, it's so good for fundraising. The demonization has helped, you know, hugely fill the coffers from the Democrats and the Republicans. And secondly, the other thing during this whole era of demonization has been, I mean, I think it's during the Reagan administration with Devers that the word spin doctoring gets created, and doesn't the media really also play a part, as we learned over the last year in all the details of the Plain case about what's going on with the way spin doctoring by each side has now set up now two total network worlds that tell us on radio and TV what the truth is from red blue state perspectives. And
okay.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no question about what the fragmentation of media is contributing to this polarization. I mean, you got, on the one hand, you got this new politics struggling to be born, and on the other hand, you've got a lot of institutions that are wedded to the old politics, and one of them is the media, and it's almost in spite of itself, but the new economics of media are that the grand old empires are shriveling. The network newscasts that used to sort of bind us together by our dining room tables are not there anymore, are not as potent as they once were, the kids are all watching Jon Stewart to get their news, and the conservatives are all watching Fox News, and the liberals are watching Chris Matthews, and you know they're not talking the same language anymore, and the bloggers are flailing at the Democrats for not being liberal enough, and the talk show hosts are flailing at the Republicans if they get off the reservation. And it's very polarizing, and our profession is contributing to it. There's no question about it. And convergence and agreement and compromise is so boring. You know, conflict is what's exciting. You know, it's the easy lead to right.
It's fundraising.
Yes, sir.
Congressman Amo Houghton used to speak of the two concentric circles of your conscience, and the larger circle being the law. And he would speak of doing well by remaining within the inner circle. Does that sort of advice resonate for you who spend your time in Washington?
I'm not sure we
understand. Yeah. Sorry.
We've been in Washington so long, we don't get it.
We're really out of touch.
Clarify it for us. Yeah.
I think I can respond. It's a familiar concept in leadership, and that is that leadership starts within, that you think about leadership. If you think about leadership as concentric circles, the innermost circle of these is the person, is the person with a conscience. And we just had Bill George here and Sidney Harmon talking about this in one of the panels here earlier in Aspen. And it's true in corporate America, and it's true in political America, that leadership is about trust. And you can't get people to trust you until you build an inner core of integrity, and that matters a lot. I remember being once with, I think this was a little overstated, but once with Alan Simpson when he introduced Jerry Ford, who is an extremely decent man of integrity, and Andrea, and all of us here had a lot of contacts with President Ford. And Alan Simpson said, you know, in politics, if you have integrity, nothing else matters. And if you don't have integrity, nothing else matters. I think a lot of people now are coming to understand that inner concentric circle is really important, but there is a circle that goes beyond that, whether and Amo used to talk about that, the law. A lot of people now talk, you've got to be able to lead within an organization. And increasingly now there's another circle out there, and you've got to be able to lead across organizations. You've got to lead not just within your own organization, you've got to learn how to lead if you're a business person with somebody else in business or somebody else in the nonprofit sector or profit sector. And if you're a member of Congress, you've got to learn to lead across your branch. You've got to learn to lead with the executive branch too. So there's a lot to his notions. And they still do have some resonance, although he's not as well remembered sometimes as he should be.
We have two more people waiting to, I'm going to try to get to both questions before we're out of time.
Hi, Deirdre Byrne from New York. You alluded earlier to a possibility of a third party coming into the picture. I'm wondering if you envision that happening anytime in the near future. Obviously, in New York, Mayor Bloomberg's precatory behavior has sort of raised this conversation.
It's preparatory behavior. I like that.
So I'm wondering if you envision that happening anytime in the near future, and if so, do you think it will involve dismantling of the Electoral College?
Well, let me say something.
Go for it, Carl. She made that threw in that Electoral College thing there at the end.
If David Gergen is right about Hillary Clinton and the polls are right about Rudy Giuliani and you're right about Mike Bloomberg, we could have three New Yorkers on the ballot in November. I'm from California, so that doesn't sit real well with me. And I mentioned this last night in a cab, and the cab to somebody that was traveling with me in the back seat, the cab driver pipes up and he said, it could be worse. We could have three people from Texas on the ballot.
But, you know, I think this Unity 08, I don't know if you're familiar with Unity 08, which Doug Bailey and Hem Jordan and Jerry Refshoon have come together, two Democrats, a Republican, in trying to get qualified in every state through online membership. And they are trying to create a vehicle for potentially a Bloomberg-Hagel ticket or something like that, some coalition politics. And I think Bloomberg is simply doing everything that one would do to get ready for this. He obviously has all the money in the world to self-finance. And if by next spring, after the February 5th Super Tuesday primaries, if the country is so divided that, let's say, Edwards is still in it and takes some of the states and Obama takes California and Hillary New York and New Jersey and Obama maybe Illinois, I mean, you can imagine a scenario where there is no clear-cut Democratic nominee. And then Bloomberg would also have to make the calculation as to whether his running, depending on who the other characters are still standing, whether it would be a spoiler role, which he would not want to do, or whether he thinks he really has a clean shot at it. No one here has mentioned Al Gore, who also, in his most recent interviews this current week, did not close the door.
Why would he?
Exactly. I mean, well, yes, he's getting a 10.
He's got books to sell.
Did he go farther than he gone before?
Not really.
I think Bloomberg gets in if he thinks that the Democrats have nominated a polarizing figure to the left and the Republicans have nominated a polarizing figure to the right, and there's this big space in the middle. And that you know, I find it unlikely that somebody with his, you know, profile in all kinds of ways, you
well,
know,
from as being he puts from, it, short.
From short, yeah, short Jewish guy, divorced from New York, anti, you know, a pro.
He life. Says this about himself.
Yes, right, pro life, pro gun, you know, pro gun control, and all that stuff. That can be a true centrist figure. I mean, I don't know what his program will be. He's got to have a program, you know, that trumps his identity as perceived by, you know, the shorthand.
Anti-gun, anti-smoking, green. I mean, there's
but
a program.
He may not be a centrist, but maybe just enough that he's an alternative. I mean, maybe that's all that people are looking for. We have a final question, then we're done.
My name is Matt Spence from the Truman National Security Project. I was wondering, what does Barack Obama need to do or what needs to happen for him to get the nomination? And I guess the flip side of that is, what needs to happen and what does Hillary Clinton need to do for her to get the nomination?
And all those other eight people are beside the point.
Yes. Yes. I'm limiting the question.
It's early.
When New Hampshire?
Well, last time, you know, the In Iowa, John Kerry won. He was not expected to win, but he did. And it stayed that way the rest of the time. And this time it's even more front-loaded. It's even more telescope. David wasn't, he's kidding on the square. You win Iowa, Barack wins Iowa and New Hampshire, he's probably going to be the nominee. Now, is that, do we really want those states to pick our nominee? I don't know. But this thing's going to happen like that. That's his scenario. Hillary Clinton doesn't have to do that. She has other scenarios. She has a lot of money. She has 100% name ID. She has the base. She has a lot going for her. So she doesn't, I mean, that's how
she can lose Iowa and place in New Hampshire and then come into February 5th with states that are very, very positive. She's ahead in California.
Right.
She's ahead in New York, New Jersey, and Florida and Illinois would probably be up for grabs.
But if what you all have said tonight on this panel is true, there is a hunger out there and there's a movement, a burning. Does that put Barack Obama in a better position to take advantage of whatever that movement is than someone who has 100% name recognition, 25% of it negative?
The problem is,
a guy who knows a lot more than me said no. So
the problem is that the primary voters tend to be liberals. It is a general electorate. The general election electorate that is centrist. Centrists don't really determine what happens in either party's primary. So that Obama, I mean, I think Obama may be premature in the Democratic Party. I may be wrong, but I think the polls suggest that. And so I don't know, I don't know exactly what he has to do. I think he has to depend on Hillary's making a big mistake of some sort. If I could just say one last thing, to the extent that you people are influential with any candidate, you give money, you talk it up and stuff like that, I mean, I would encourage you to encourage them to think about governing, to think they've got to win their nomination, but they also ought to think about how they are going to govern and how they're going to get 60 votes in the United States Senate.
One little footnote, Gwen. The other thing that I think is a bit distressing is that for all the debates, we really have not had serious conversations with these candidates. The American people have not had. They do not, some of the candidates in particular, have not permitted themselves to be interviewed. They seem to feel in the YouTube world that they can make a virtue of this by doing web videos and not doing any kind of interaction with the press, and mainstream or otherwise. And I think that they are making a very big mistake. They'll pay a very heavy price, because that's the way Ronald Reagan was reelected in 1984. He did not have a single press conference between declaring that he was running in June and being reelected. We chased after him, we shouted, you all heard the, Mr. President, with the helicopters and all of that. And that was not good for the country, it was not good for Reagan, and we saw the second term problems that ensued because he had not been forced to grapple with some of these major issues.
Well, here's the good news. It's only July of 2007. So we'll be having this conversation exactly in the same spot next time, next year, and maybe we'll have an idea who the nominees are, and we'll just be able to be more specific about it. Thank you. They were very well behaved, weren't they? Thank you. They were terrific.
Well, with one exception.
Thank you.